Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable Podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha Marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. The opinions expressed on this podcast represent those of the people expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. I'm joined today by Seeking Alpha Marketplace original and longtime contributor, Chris DeMuth Jr., who runs the Sifting the World Marketplace service here at SeekingAlpha.com. Chris is the founder of the New Canaan, Connecticut-based Rangeley Capital LLC, an investment firm that focuses on event-driven, value-oriented investment opportunities. Rangeley has three funds, including one that is specifically focused on SPACs, which will be the topic of today's conversation. Via his Sifting the World Seeking Alpha Marketplace service, Chris searches the world for misplaced bets, offering subscribers advice that matches his real-world investing strategies at Rangeley. Before founding Rangeley Capital, Chris did public policy research in Washington, D.C. for hedge funds interested in antitrust and regulatory affairs. You can subscribe to Sifting the World by going to SeekingAlpha.com and typing Sifting the World or Chris DeMuth into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to SeekingAlpha.com/marketplace and looking for Sifting the World there. All right, let's get into it, Chris. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great you've been able to join me here. And I know we went a little bit back and forth on the schedule. I think you were originally supposed to come on the show today. I pushed you to next week. You were able to move it back up. And I think that's actually really great because SPACs are just all over the place right now. In fact, I'm based in Jerusalem, as some people may or may not know. And there was an article atop one of the local news sites here just talking about how big SPACs are right now. And this is not an investment-focused site. There's been a lot of Israeli companies that have gone public via SPACs and just a lot of companies everywhere that have gone public via SPACs. So let's get into it. First of all, for people that are maybe less in the know right now, what is a SPAC exactly? And why is it that you think they're having a moment right now?
A SPAC is a special purpose acquisition corp, and it is a company that first raises money and secondly finds an operating business. So you start off with a guy or a group of guys or guys and gals or a gal and a pile of money, and that's all you know day one. So it is a bit of a regulatory arbitrage or a bit of a regulatory workaround in that the most lengthy, time-consuming, involved, lawyered up of SEC filings is the S-1. And so the more there is to say, the longer and more difficult the S-1 review is. So if you have a operating business and you have customers and competitors and vendors and cash flow and earnings, and a balance sheet, the SEC is going to ask you detailed questions about every single one of these. If you have no problems with any of those, well, it'll be a lengthy process. If you have any problems with any of those, it'll be a lengthier process. And that's a big deal going public. And so in anything to do with lawyers, any information, even benign information, is problematic in that it just takes longer. We're involved in litigation from time to time in Delaware doing appraisals. And my lawyer has had to say more than once, because my first whack at dealing with lawyers was, they're smart, I'm right, why don't I just explain things? And my lawyers always say, don't volunteer anything. And I think there's several people with full-time jobs whose only job is to tell me don't volunteer anything, because I kind of feel like I want to be the problem solver and jump in and be a hero and say a lot of things. But the S-1 for a SPAC is the filing version of not volunteering anything, because you're just a guy and money. It's as simple as it can be. Subsequently, you buy the operating business. So it is a way to come to market very quickly and efficiently.
Sure. And why is it that you think, beyond, let's say, just the fact that you can shave key time off of the listing process, why is it that you think SPACs are having a moment right now? Because certainly this structure and this opportunity has been around for more than the last couple of years. And yet it seems like there's more, and this might actually be the case, there are more companies listing via SPACs than in the traditional listing method right now.
Well, I've been doing this for over a decade, and the first 90% of that involved getting very little attention. It's been a wonderful investment for us for a long time, but it, elicited no questions or interest from the general public. You could go years without ever having any questions about it. It was just kind of my quiet little sleepy corner of the capital markets, or one of my sleepy little corners of the capital markets that we tried to exploit for myself and for my investors. Why now? Goodness, it is part of whatever's happened in the past year, a couple of years really, but more dramatically in an environment when you combine COVID and zero interest rates. And I've kind of thought about this a lot this week. I wrote a piece yesterday morning called N equals one, just saying that, look, this is a sample size of one. Yeah. We've had this thing happen. And whatever's happened over the past 12 months is something that I think is going to be very modest in its predictive ability in terms of what happens next. And if you did a lot of things that seemed like they worked, it's possible that you were really just doing one thing, which was a world with no opportunity cost, a world where if you're in your mom's basement and stuck there for a year, you have nothing else to do. If you have no riskless rate of return, you also have no hurdle rate. And so you didn't need cash flow. You could do the most speculative things possible. Almost every collectible has performed spectacularly in the last 12 months.
Funny you mentioned that. Yeah, I spent like a full day just looking up prices of baseball cards that I had in my parents' attic this summer, and the prices on some of them was just mind-boggling. Like,
yeah, no, if you had a decent collection, you're probably a baseball card millionaire right now. And even kind of exotic things, certainly almost every crypto, almost every kind of weird newfangled collective, you don't need cash flow. And one of the aspects of SPACs, although it's only one of the aspects, it's not what's particularly enticing about it to me, is that the SEC keeps a pretty tight rein on IPO claims, that marketing yourself on future contemplated performance is something that they hold the reins on pretty tight, but you can go for it in SPACs. And so if you look at how SPACs are marketed because of the going public as a shell corp, subsequently buying the operating business, a lot of these are in that category of what happened to be in favor this past year. And that's not a mistake. I think that the driving characteristic of a SPAC is that it's market driven. What I like about that is that, unlike an IPO where there's lots of arbitrariness, where banker numbers are kind of put together by people who kind of have a thought and then the market subsequently acts, we market participants get to chime in on every stage of the SPAC, from before the S1 to after the de-SPACing. Every single step of the way is the result of a conversation with investors. And so if we are talking to them and going back and forth, the good thing is there's a lot of information in the price. I won't even call it a bad thing, but an attribute of it is the sponsors know what the investors want. So they're giving the people what they want. And that is increasingly over the past year in tech, specifically in electric vehicles and batteries, in certain types of SaaS and certain types of biotech. But that in some ways might've been temporary or might've been very colored by the market we've had over the past year. I think what comes next is probably different, but I think it still very much will involve SPACs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. And so I know that at Rangeley, you're doing things with SPACs on a regular basis, and you're involved with different parts of the process. So which parts of the process are you involved in? Are you underwriting? Are you simply just investing directly? Or what sorts of involvement do you have with SPACs?
Well, we're not underwriters. We are outside minority passive investors always. But as outsiders, I would describe us as the most sponsor-oriented of outsiders of any investment company, so that when a sponsor is starting, just contemplating doing an IPO, we're having conversations with them kind of before the beginning. You know, we go back and forth, we hear their pitch, we give our feedback, we offer what we'd invest in, what we wouldn't. Things are a little different over the past couple months when the performance has led to this kind of glut of new money sloshing in, right? So you have the average IPO to deal unit return has been about 60%, and it's taken about a third of a year. Well,
wow.
I would happily do this for a tenth of the return, and it would probably be more stable. At this level, it's a bit of a circus. In terms of people who are flooding in. So you can imagine my conversations with sponsors kind of negotiating what we do or not do is more like, yes, please, sir, we would love to, please take my money. Whereas historically, it was much more of a real negotiation where when you look at the units, when you look at what is actually IPO'd, it is a combination of different securities. And historically, X the last few months, that was not just randomly put together. It was negotiated and negotiated by me or people like me in a back and forth with sponsors to try to get to the right composition that would have the right amount of market demand.
Sure. And I think just to get into the that return part of it for a second here, you're saying to IPO. So, and I think this will be instructive for, again, for listeners that are a little less clear on the dynamics here. So when SPACs list, unlike a direct listing, they must return the money to shareholders within a set period of time, correct? How does that work exactly?
So how that works is there are certain numbers that are kind of the cultural norm, and there are only a couple counterexamples. These specific numbers are not by statute. They're just by how the people who write these things tend to write them.
Okay.
You almost always have an IPO at $10 per unit. $10 is arbitrary, typically how they do it. That unit typically consists of one share, just like any other stock, but it also often has other things. In a few cases, it's actually only that share, but typically it has some warrants. So today, a typical warrant structure might be a quarter of a warrant, or thinking about it differently, for every four units you have four shares and a warrant. To mention it, a very few have rights as well. So that's so some of these have three different securities within a unit, and they list them. They, after a certain period of time, it works out to about 52 days, the investor can choose to split them apart. Just for completeness' sake, I'll mention there are a few that is involuntary. It's usually voluntary. So you can keep the original structure, the basket or unit, or break them apart. And they have a shot clock. It is typically, but not always, a two-year shot clock. As an outside investor, one of the things I'm really listening for is if they have any intention of using much of that time. Is this some guy who thinks, I'll get a SPAC, all my friends at the club have SPACs, I was feeling left out, and then I'll spend the next 2 years seeing, hey, is there anything I should buy? That will be much less interesting to me than somebody who's done this, say, four times extremely successfully, and I rather suspect they had a fifth target in mind. They just didn't get to it. They have very good relationships. I would not want to invest in any SPAC sponsor that thought that part of this would be introducing themselves to potential targets after they started. I want all that done ahead of time. I want people who are just waiting. Now, part of the waiting is a compliance regulatory issue. Were you to know specifically who you were buying, that would have to be included in the S1. It wouldn't be a SPAC anymore. So you cannot know. And it's going to be looked upon with great skepticism if you pick something very quickly. So you kind of want to, you know, if you know who you're going to buy and you kind of can work it out in a day or so, you might want to play golf for a few months to let it cool off before you announce it.
Yeah.
So they're happening much more quickly. I mean, it used to be typical that they would use, say, 18 months. And now, boy, there are getting done in lightning speed, which, of course, from my perspective, is great because it really helps my IRR.
Do you think that's indicative of the current market environment, or is there some funny business going on in some of these cases also?
Well, in a couple of recent cases, they actually got a deal announced before their units were even split. So I think that they're kind of on the bleeding edge of what people are going to feel comfortable with from the enforcement agencies. But I think that it's indicative mostly of the market. And if they're in a hot market, it is people who want to act at kind of a point where there's competition for deals. Some of them are even in SPAC off kind of auction like situations between SPACs. And so there's a feeling that now's the time. But for whatever reason, they're going very quickly right now, faster than I've ever seen before.
Yeah. So I want to just drill into this a little bit more just to, I think, make it real for people that are listening. And let's take a company that started off as a SPAC, which I think will be very well known to many people, DraftKings. Mm-hmm. Now, DraftKings is a company that clearly was already growing very, very rapidly, huge revenue growth with the rise of daily fantasy sports and just increasing legalization of sports betting in general. What is in it for the people that privately held DraftKings to end up going public via this route and not going public via more traditional IPO route? And why would they choose to go in this direction, basically?
Sure. So DraftKings is the third most successful de-SPACed equity in all time. It's a little bit easy to think about this in terms of the stock price, which usually in isolation has no particular meaning. But if you think about it, it presumably in this case did come from $10 a unit to start.
Yeah, it did. Sure.
So when you think about it, a Diamond Eagle Acquisition Corp, the company, the SPAC that de-SPACed DraftKings, was IPO'd, that was something that started as a share and a third of a warrant, was just how theirs happened to be structured. And they IPO'd in the middle of 2019. This was a time when there was increasing enthusiasm for gaming companies. It was kind of increasingly in favor. So if you think about it, both from the entrepreneur, private company management side and investor side, and from the SPAC side, as something becomes in favor and is interesting to public markets, some of what you're doing is to overuse the word arbitrage, arbitraging the public market to private market valuation. It would take a long time to discover, gaming is increasingly popular. Gaming is kind of the next iteration in sports. In the US, a lot of our states are very, very broke. Whatever kind of moralistic inclination you have to doing anything that you can tax right now is going to be overwhelmed by the fact that our state, certainly my home state of Connecticut, is completely broke. New York's broke, New Jersey's broke, Illinois's broke, California's broke. And so they're going to do whatever they can to make money. So
ironically, many of the states you just mentioned actually still do not have legal sports games.
But that'll absolutely change.
That'll change for sure.
In fact, down the road for me, there is a very curious mall that was built, a new mall. And if you think, why would anybody build a big new indoor mall? And it's kind of right off of 95, the big kind of East Coast highway.
Sure.
And it's a casino that they built. They built the floors, they built everything, you know, a massive casino that is set up. I mean, I think within 48 hours, they could flip the switch. All of their contracts are short-term contracts and the thing's only half filled, but it's only built to be half filled, and they can turn it on as a casino kind of over the weekend. The Soviets had built a lot of their military factories with nominal civilian purposes. You know, they would have cigarettes that they would make, but it was in the perfect caliber to switch over to make Kalashnikov rounds. You know, they could switch it in a day. Same thing with trucks to tanks. And at least in Connecticut, I know of one example where they've done the same thing, kind of getting ready for full gaming legalization, not far behind with marijuana legalization. I don't know specifically where they are on prostitution, but I mean, pretty much anything they can tax. You could take the other side of that conversation, but their states are broke. They're going to do everything they possibly can.
It's a pendulum. They'll legalize everything until there starts being the actual social cost, and they realize, well, for all the money you're bringing in, you may actually be paying more at the other end of it. But
yes,
in the meantime,
and they've kind of raised visible direct taxation about as high as they can without just losing their revenue base. I mean, Connecticut has the problem of we have the most mobile revenue base of any of the 50 states. If I had a copper mine in Montana and I was pushed around by the state, I couldn't do much. But if I have a hedge fund in Connecticut, the average guy with a hedge fund in Connecticut already has a home in Florida. So, you know, it really is, you have to stop by a Teterboro on the way out of town, but you can be gone in a day. So they've abused us about as badly as they can.
I guess that works until Florida is underwater in about 50 years. But for now, that's a working strategy.
Yeah, but you have what? Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Wyoming, Puerto Rico. Even there are more enviable options. In any event, it's something states have to contend with. And so, kind of starting at about 2019, it became very clear that this was going to be a hot market. And I can kind of think about it in two ways. You know, if you think about the kind of value investing saw on the short-term voting machine, long-term weighing machine, when I approach SPACs, I think about both. And so just for a moment, talking about the voting machine, this was going to be a kind of thing in favor. And once that becomes clear, both sides can act, and they can act with more alacrity than they could in any other vehicle. A number of companies were relisting in the US, and in two cases, they were ones that we had substantial investments in, but this was one that was freshly listing. It has many of the characteristics that make for a great voting machine SPAC. It certainly doesn't have the ESG part. That's often very positive, as are just kind of aspirational brands. But it is helpful while you are newly facing the public investing market if you have a brand name that is already well known, so that you don't really need to newly introduce yourself. I was saying it's helpful for the SPAC team to not have to introduce themselves. It's helpful for the brand to not have to introduce themselves. So kind of early on, if you're SPACing something like a, kind of an earlier version of this, was Twinkies. You know, people, you know, have you heard of Twinkie? You know, that's, you know, so if it's a B2B or, you know, some kind of middle of a industrial organization, kind of a valve in a factory, could be just as valuable as a Twinkie. But if I have to kind of spend half an hour explaining it, it's not going to have the salience with retail investors as Twinkies do or DraftKings do. I mean, heck, if you look at thinking about the kind of N equals 1 year over the past 12 months, if you look at a lot of behavior investors, a lot of their trading apps were built on sports betting. So this is largely bettors. The kind of people who would use DraftKings to place bets are also the kind of people who would place bets on DraftKings. So it's kind of picture perfect SPAC. And can get in front of that audience.
So just to understand here, what do the people that, let's say, what are the owners of DraftKings the day before they actually decided to go this route? What does this end up netting them relative to a more traditional direct listing where they have a lockup period and then they get to just, you know, float share their own shares onto the open market and sell them at a market value?
Sure, it's more market based. It doesn't have that. It doesn't have that big cliff of kind of pre-IPO, post-IPO. In this case, pre-existing owners rolled over their equity, so that, you know, it's the buyers are buying into it. But if you look at the cap structure of a lot of these, they're quite a bit bigger than just the equity that was in the trust. So you have the equity in the trust. Typically, you also have a PIPE, a private investment in the public equity. And then you have the pre-existing owners. So one of the things that I really look for in this case, generally really am interested in is, are the sellers rolling over equity? So kind of taking it public and the SPAC sponsors being people who will be helpful in adding value could be both positives, but it's at least something you think about as an outside investor, that there could be a moral hazard and adverse selection in terms of the most knowledgeable people with inside information trying to foist something off on SPACs, especially when there are a lot of SPACs with a lot of money, and there's this shot clock. If you have somebody in the last moments of their two-year process, one thing that I'm always wary of is, are they just gonna find a deal, any deal? The sponsors themselves have risk capital. It can be more or less, it's typically a high seven-figure amount of money. So when you look at who does SPACs, I mean, who should do SPACs, but these days really who does, they're top people in hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, industry, and they're people who can write, you know, personally write, between two or three guys can write, you know, $8 million, $10 million, mm-hmm. something like that. And that's their skin in the game.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. All right. So moving along here, I think it would be interesting to discuss some of the exchange traded funds out there.
Sure.
Because this is going to be syndicated to Let's Talk ETFs podcast. We'll also put it out on the Marketplace Roundtable. But I think just because the three SPAC-focused ETFs right now take quite different approaches from each other. And so I think it could be an interesting entry point into, well, for an investor who's kind of looking in a top-down kind of a way, and obviously, you know, you're looking at SPACs in your day-to-day in a bottom-up kind of a way also. You're looking at the individual companies, but just in terms of how to think about this space generally. So there's currently three ETFs whose mandate is to invest in SPACs. And some of them are investing in SPACs, both pre and post-merger. Some of them are only pre-merger SPACs. The three funds are the Defiance Next Gen SPAC-derived ETF, ticker symbol SPAK. That one's got a little over $100 million in AUM right now. And this is the one that tracks a passively constructed index of both pre and post-merger SPACs. I believe it's the oldest of the group, and I know it's one you've written about on Seeking Alpha. Then there's the $190 million in assets actively managed SPAC and new issue ETF, ticker symbol SPCX, and this selects only pre-merger SPACs. And finally, the smallest of the group is the Morgan Creek Exos SPAC originated ETF, ticker symbol SPXE. It's got just under $50 million in AUM right now, and it actively selects both pre and post-merger SPACs. First of all, do you have a favorite of the three here? I know you're probably not buying ETFs yourself. You can go out and actually just figure out which SPACs you think have the most upside, but do you have a favorite of the three there?
I do. And I believe that each iteration has been an improvement upon the predecessor. Mm-hmm. I think the third, the youngest one is by far my favorite of the three. The first and second have different issues that I think needed to be addressed. I should start frame this by saying that I am a huge fan of ETFs. Mm-hmm. As much as I think before we started, I said, well, I'm a stock picker. I do asset allocation. So I think about this, like, you know, before I had hair, my barber would think I need a haircut and my butcher thinks I need to eat more meat. I think you should pick securities on your own, or at least have someone do that versus having it done passively or kind of outsourced like in an index fund or an ETF. So I'm hugely a fan of ETFs generally. mostly with passively managed, very broad based ones. I think a lot of the mischief within markets that are avoided by ETFs are avoided best with the broad ones, where I, as the kind of person who goes around exploiting arbitrariness for profit, find most of my opportunities, it's right on the margin of ETFs that are very specific. So ETFs that are constructed to for only stocks that pay dividends, say, or for very specific indexes, I find lots and lots of ways to profit from them where they are the counterparty. So generally I like ETFs that, you know, if I was talking to my sister and trying to give her some investment for her money, other than investing with me, I would, you know, kind of want a broad one. So these are a little bit more specific. The first one.
Sorry, just before you get into this, do you ever use ETFs at Rangeley? For example, let's say you're sitting on a pile of cash, you're not ready to invest it. You ever just plow it into something just because of the liquidity, or just to get a, you know, couple hundred basis points, or not really in your.
No, I think the closest we come to it is buying and selling things that are coming into or leaving an index. So we've had positions that we've owned and written about that part of the thesis was they were going to be an unexpected entrant.
You're talking about like a Russell rebalance kind of plan.
For example, we had another one that was booted because of a cutting off their dividend temporarily. It was a huge part of a dividend ETF and the stock price imploded, but it was just as valuable. And it was not only just as valuable, but quite likely to be added right back a few months later. So it was a, you know, a huge value.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. So yeah,
that's
so back
the closest we would do.
Okay, cool.
It would never occur to me to buy or sell one directly. The first one of these three.
And just to remind people which one you're talking about here, because they may be listening, they may not have a screen open in front of them. So the first of the three, again, is the Defiance NextGen SPAC-derived ETF. That's ticker symbol SPAK, and that's the oldest of the three.
Yes. And it has the best ticker symbol.
I mean, it does.
Catchy ticker symbols are always helpful. So SPAK, I wish them well. If you've invested in it, great. It does none of the things that attracts me to SPACs. So it's largely de-SPACed equities. Now, when you think about de-SPACed equities, it's important to bifurcate the world as it's been up into kind of March 2020, and then subsequently. So some of my cautionary notes that I've given about this tactic fall on deaf ears, or even people are literally confused, because things that I would generally think of as risky have been spectacularly successful this past year. I mean, one of the best indicators of great stock performance over the past 12 months has been not just a company that is not profitable, but a company that's never been profitable. It's one of the best categories of things to invest in over the last 12 months. That's not indicative of how things have been historically over the past 10 years. I rather suspect that's not how things are going to be in the future either. But I'm very cautious about de-SPACed equities. It's something that I look at skeptically. We've talked about you buy a unit at the beginning in an IPO. You can hold that for up to 2 years. It's only taken about a third of a year recently. They can find something. You basically you're getting a ticket for a free peek at what some hopefully presumably smart people would do with the amount of money that they have temporarily borrowed in order to find something great that is great enough that you're going to want to stay. And after the free peek, if you were just to blindly say yes to everything, I think one of the best ways to be successful in the capital markets is to be radically selective. You say no almost all the time. And when your downside goes from $10 to zero, it's just like any other equity, historically over the longer period of time, other than this past year, you're stuck with any other equity, sometimes small, sometimes where the sponsors have just taken 20% of the value in promote or in shares for them, their compensation's high, you should get the inverse of that. So your $10 should become, all else being equal, worth about eight. Very similar to if you invested in a closed end fund IPO. If you look at their performance, one way that the market's really efficient is a broker, probably a sleazy broker, says, hey, I would really, really suggest that you, and for them, instead of 10, it's 25, really, you should take all your money. You know, they'll call your grandmother and say, you know, it costs you $25. The reason why they're so enthusiastic is they just take two right off the top. Instead of taking 2 pennies or 1 penny, they take $2 for their trouble. Well, the market knows this, right? So they'll trade down bucks would be efficient, right? It might trade down $7.90, might trade down $8. It might trade down 8.1 or 7.9%, but it should correct for that right away, all else being equal. SPACs historically have had that same phenomenon, which is, you know, if somebody's going to take 20% of the value for themselves, your 10 should become $8. Maybe it's $7.50, maybe it's $8.50.
This is why, just as I guess an aside, there are indexers or fund managers, I think Dimension Fund Advisors is one of them, that simply have a hard and fast rule of avoiding newly IPO'd.
Yes. So just doing that blindly to me seems suboptimal. And it's something that I would be very wary of doing. I am not
long. It's the problem with indexes. You just have to create rules. You're not allowed to amend them as you go along.
So. I'm not long or short this at the moment, but somebody with a SPAC investment portfolio, it could be a very useful hedge. So it might be something one might look to short or buy puts or write calls on against a SPAC portfolio. These things do tend to have a fairly high correlation day to day, even with things that substantively shouldn't have anything to do with one another. So it could actually be a useful hedge. There are a couple other specific problems with it. They do not participate in IPOs. So year to date, the average day one pop after the IPO has been about 7%.
Okay.
Great if you're in the IPO, but you're paying that if you're not in it. So that's a serious weakness. The second serious weakness is they do not trade, they're not involved in equity options. Equity options can be very, very useful. If you look at how these trade, there's the option, there's the equity, there's the warrant. There have been wild mispricings between those. And so the ability to have a flexible mandate where you can own whatever's cheapest, you can sell whatever's most expensive, a huge amount of the opportunity is there.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of weaknesses, I think, in the first, just relative to its construction, that I think was improved upon in the second.
Okay. And the second one, just to remind people at home, is the largest of the group, almost $200 million in AUM at this point, and launched just in December 2020.
Yeah.
So a pretty nice pickup of assets out of the gate. And that's the SPAC and new issue ETF, ticker symbol SPCX. It's Tuttle Tactical Management is the issuer on that.
And I think that they did quite a bit to improve upon the structure of the first. I think that they have a better business in not being post, but being pre. I have a different problem with that. Not to be cranky about each of the structures, but I have a lot of flexibility, and I use that flexibility to stay very close to sponsors. To most of my time day to day is not in the public secondary markets. It's talking to people, structuring security, structuring the units, negotiating access. Why would anybody want to be on the other side of that conversation with me? Well, we stick with them for the long term. We are good outside minority passive investors because we're flexible, we're very liquid, we're scaled to the point where we can, you know, participate with, say, 10% of an offering. We can come in with pipes. We can come in with founder shares. Whatever you might need as a sponsor, we're very happy to provide. And our flexibility is such that we could act quickly or slowly. If I was trying to have a conversation with you and say, hey, I love this thing that I want, but I just need to be very clear, I'm not sticking with you, no matter what you find. If you find a great deal, I'm not even looking at it. I don't quite understand why they would. I'm always asking myself, why would somebody want to do business with me? What's the upside to the other side of the conversation? And the fact that we do, I like to think, very good work, but we certainly do work, fundamental analysis of every single target. and we seriously consider staying with it forever, we were open to that, we're able to that, in some cases we have, is kind of what I'm offering. So if I buy policy never did that, I think I would have a lot of doors slammed in my face in terms of access. It would only be coincidence, or it would be a misunderstanding that anybody would want to do business with me. I'm not sure what I'd be offering. I think it's odd when people kind of go out publicly with SPAC arbitrage. I mean, why would anybody want, I think you'd have a horrible adverse selection of who would want to deal with that, because there's no rational reason for a sponsor to want to do business. I mean, I am very interested in businesses and firms and understanding a company, mm-hmm. and have only passing interest in the stock market. I'm really similar to how a lot of the sponsors think about targets. And intellectually, I kind of start at the end and work back. I'm thinking about this for the long term. I'm not playing games. I'm not flipping IPOs. I'm not playing stock market games around these very specific little splices, which, besides the fact that it's kind of exploitable, is not that interesting to a sponsor. So I think that it would have an access problem and an allocation problem to only be in at the beginning. But if I was forced to choose, as you are between the first and the second, would I want to only be in after de-SPACing? And take into account with de-SPACing, boy, smart bankers have every incentive to make this thing as attractive as possible. You know, you have the slide deck, you have the conference call, you have the press release, you have everything possible to tart it up as well as you can. This is the after that, right? This is after that. If I could be before or after, I certainly would be before. But that brings me to the third of the three choices, which I think is by far the preferable one, which is...
And this one has only been around since January of this year. So we're talking maybe 6 weeks here, already gathered close to $50 million in AUM. And just to remind listeners, we're talking about the Morgan Creek Exos SPAC originated ETF, ticker symbol SPXZ. The issuer is MCCM Group. And of course, Morgan Creek is the actual manager of the fund here.
And if you have a smart guy with some flexibility and he can use that, he doesn't have to, but could stay in post-SPACing. I mean, I think that's the best of all worlds. And I should say, even when there's not a lot of flexibility, there is some. In the first of the three SPACs, they didn't include Nikola, which I thought was very interesting. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it was done in a pretty formulaic way. So I think they're improving. I think, as often happens, there's a rush to get in. People are excited about SPACs, but I think each iteration has gotten a little better than the previous version.
Right. And I guess to some extent, none of these funds have much of a track record at this point. So this is probably something we can revisit in 6 months or a year from now and see how, particularly with the second and third fund we discussed, again, because they're actively managed, you know, maybe they'll have some tricks up their sleeve that you weren't counting on at this point, for good or for bad. So could be interesting to revisit this at some point. So in terms of, I guess, I'd love to just have a brief conversation about an individual SPAC maybe that you're excited about right now, and leave listeners with that. You obviously write about SPACs regularly on Seeking Alpha, particularly for subscribers of your marketplace service, Sifting the World. They get your commentary on this slice of the market all the time throughout the day. So obviously that's pretty awesome for people that are interested in this space. What's one SPAC that you're particularly excited about right now?
Well, one of the things I really look for is I like repeat sponsors that you can kind of get to know and have confidence in what they're doing. So instead of just kind of picking one specific one, DMY is one of the SPAC sponsors, which I would say is one that I like, trust, have a lot of confidence and interest in, and so kind of stay tuned on what they're doing. They've had a number of them and they've all been quite successful. DMY, they de-SPAC'd Rush Street was their first. None of these are terribly creative about names. They kind of just tend to go through the name, kind of 1, 2, and 3. The second one did Genius Sports. They tend to be quick, decisive security selectors and have a lot of interesting things that they've done. There's one that if you look at their number 3, DMYI is the ticker on the units. Kind of big fans of theirs. They are one that I mentioned today because they're in the press. It hasn't been formally announced yet, but they're one that is being discussed as a potential deal shortly. And they have ones that are, you know, it's reasonable to expect that they would have subsequent SPACs coming up. But that's the kind of company that I would say makes me most interested to start at the beginning and go through the end. We would typically be involved in the IPO. We would typically hold those units. We actually do split the units when it's time to split them. It's just a little bit more transparent for us to be able to look at the separate shares and units, but it's quite likely that we would kind of go from the beginning to end and see what DMY owns. Now in the secondary market, the consideration is a little different. So I'm really just in the primary market, or you know, buying them, and how just the mechanics work is you nominally go through the underwriters or the banks that are working for the sponsors. You typically would talk to them, but we also would talk to the SPAC sponsor themselves, get an allocation, hang on to things. Secondary market, you know, I think a lot of it is being very price sensitive. So the couple prices that I think a lot about when I'm thinking about the secondary market, and this is for, say, I'm writing about and sifting the world, there's a huge amount of overlap, but not perfect overlap, between my kind of day job in security selection and writing about it, doing the research and sifting the world. You got to be very sensitive to the price. So if the average pop this year has been 7% or so, you're talking about a unit, call it $10.70, give or take. A way to frame the question is, how much quality is there for even an average priced one? So if you can find one from, say, $10.70 to $11, you're somewhat similar to what the IPO opportunity is. And if you can get one of the really high quality, sponsors for that kind of range, that's good. Now there's another consideration to think about the really low priced units, which is unit prices I find in the secondary market are somewhat sensitized to the intended sector. So does a SPAC have a sexy plan for what they're gonna do with their money? Mm-hmm. Those tend to do much better. So ESG is very much in favor. Anything to do with EVs, batteries, or that people think might head in that direction, very popular. However, somebody in a non-sexy category can just switch. There's no legal teeth to intended sector. It's just words. And so Sometimes you have a kind of stodgy sounding one that says, forget this, I'm going in for batteries, you know, just because that's what the people want right now. Yeah. And so I think that sometimes, you know, you can also kind of peek at the very low price components, and a low price component right now. And whole sections of history have happened where you're actually buying at a big discount to the trust value. That's extremely rare right now. But the kind of low priced unit are ones where you're talking kind of 10 to 1050. You can find some stuff in there. You're going to find many fewer of the kind of big name brand SPACs. You know, I think that those are the two in the secondary market opportunities that you can think about are the super cheap, or the you got to pay up a little bit more, but kind of finding the high quality names. And then DMY is the one that I'm just throwing out because there's a whole bunch of them you can look at that is you know, the kind that I will be spending most of my time, you know, looking to put real money to work in.
Nice. Anyway, Chris, this has been awesome. I think there's a lot for people to chew on here. Before we go, though, if you want to just maybe make a plug for Sifting the World and just kind of tell people a little more about your process, why it is that you get so much out of writing and communicating, how it helps your investing process, and then just kind of what a typical day looks like, at least a trading day, let's say.
Sure. So I'll give you the literal three-part origin story of Sifting the World. Part one, Ellie Hoffman, my friend, asked me to do it. So I said, sure. And he said, it's going to be a subscription service. And I said yes, and I did not get the idea. I didn't get why. My day job is in, you know, we're not a philanthropy. We do, in fact, charge fees to our limited partners, but we charge for investing money if we make money in investing. So I said, I don't know, Ellie. Charge them a dollar, I guess. I don't know why are we charging them? It's kind of seems embarrassing. I don't know why we do that. But it ended up having a very good purpose for me, which is if I'm doing something that's at all public or at all interesting to the public, and SPACs certainly for whatever reason right now are, I get inbound questions, usually phrased as kind of homework assignments from anonymous internet strangers every 20 or 30 seconds. And if I get a question and it's something I know something about, it's very hard for me to completely ignore and just hit delete. But it would also be incapacitating for me to kind of interrupt my work every time I get a question and just do it. So it's a little bit like Gerson Lehrman or like some of the expert networks that just attacks that puts a value on your time. Actually massively improves the caliber of conversation because you're just dealing with people that actually assign some value to it. Secondly, there were some of the things that I wrote about in the public on Seeking Alpha that actually were self-defeating, that were corporate actions that because I wrote about it were withdrawn. Mm-hmm. And people who were able to find them turned to me and said, Chris, we've been doing this for years. Why are you ruining stuff for people who know about these just to give them away to the public, and it's ruining them? And I said, you're right. I shouldn't have. Oops, sorry. And so I put all of that in a paid service in a community where they get my best research ideas. My best implementation goes in my fund. My best research goes in Sifting the World. And it's kind of like a faculty lounge where people can talk about ideas and they get my best ideas. And they get it in a scale that really works with my schedule. So you asked what a day looks like. I wake up at 3:30 in the morning, 7 days a week.
You start working hours around the same time as I do, even though you're seven time zones behind me.
Yes, no, it's perfect. I wake up in the morning and I usually have about a half dozen or so ideas, and I never think about them at that identical moment. So there's usually about a half dozen, I think you could attest, emails around that time of day, thoughts I have and ideas I want to share. But I read for a few hours. I have one of the groups within Sifting the World that is just me sharing, not as much even me on transmit, but me on receive. Here are the things that I'm reading. Here are the things I'm thinking about. Here are some of the corporate actions happening, and kind of a literally a chat about that for people who want to play along. And then I do a half hour in the Peloton, but I usually work from the Peloton. I have a little desk working from the Peloton while I do that. And CrossFit kind of mid-morning for me, but you know, 5 to 7-ish or so. Mm-hmm. And then a bit of a run and a bit of time outside, and then kind of get back to clean up and get back to work. And then I prepare for our two, we have weekly pieces, a weekly piece on SPACs, a weekly piece on everything else. But sometimes somebody comes in and there seems to be a bit of, it's a very active community, but there seems to be some chaos in terms of what is it that I'm really doing? And it always seems clear to me, there's a method to the madness, which is I'm interested in the price system itself. I'm not interested in taking my fair share of risk for a reward. I'm interested in very peculiar situations where the price system fails to assign risk properly, where it breaks down, where it does something other than assigned risk. So a category for me that's incredibly interesting is a demutualization, where you put money in federally insured in a depository account. Your downside is just your opportunity cost, which is an idea that comes back time and time again for things that I'm interested in. So I, or actually in this case, my wife, for whatever reason, it was done in her account, her largest position, you can buy shares, buy 200,000 shares in a financial institution based on a deposit account. And you get to buy it, it worked out to be mid-60s% of tangible book value of an institution that has your cash in it. So my analogy to these demutualizations is if you bought a car, we're driving it off the lot, and the salesman said, oh, by the way, thanks for, I don't know, you spent $10,000 on the car. Thanks for buying the car. Just want to let you know I left all the cash in the glove compartment for you. And you said, oh, thanks. You know, because the bank obviously still has the cash that you sent them. So you send them $2 million. It's trading day one. It opens at coincidentally, like in the case of SPACs, $10 a share, you know, and we just today, I think, sold our last share. It's trading at $17.50 from mid-October to mid-February. So that's the kind of thing that I like. And I don't like making 75% in a few months. I don't dislike that. But what I like is, there was no mechanism to assign me the appropriate level of risk for the reward. You got in because of your access to something. It's like being in a commune. Like if you were in a hippie commune, if you were in a social group, say you were in a kibbutz and they discovered oil. There's two good things about it. One is you discovered oil, but two, not everybody wants it. So maybe some other guys kind of wandered off and left and did something else. You were sitting on this pile of oil and there was all this accretion because they were not necessarily profit seekers who got into the situation where they owned it in common with you. So your percentage ends up being much more than you deserve because of that. So I love demutualizations. SPACs have the same attribute. If I put in $10 and it goes really well, that $10 might end up being 30, 40, 50. And if it goes horribly wrong, my $10 becomes $10. So I've long had the kind of tongue-in-cheek joke that I'm a value investor because if I'm going to put money at risk, I kind of want to know ahead of time what I'm going to get, or at least what it's worth. I'm just a counter. I'm not a soothsayer. I need something for what I pay, and I don't take leaps of faith. I don't need to take a leap of faith. I've never really taken a leap of faith. I like something that is not a sure thing in the outcome. There's good outcomes and bad outcomes, but a sure thing at a substantial discount to the expected value. Well, in SPACs, I say, I can't be a speculative investor unless I can do a do-over. In SPACs, you actually get a do-over. You actually get your money back if you don't like the deal. And so that to me was just wildly, obviously interesting and something I could get a lot of money to work in. And so even though right now there's a lot of activity in SPACs, we happen to be writing about and thinking about and talking about and investing money in SPACs, and that's a big topic in sifting the world, it was something else 5 years ago. It'll be something else 5 years from now. But what will unite all of it is pricing failure, of getting the potential to profit and taking some unfair advantage where a lot of what you're doing is identifying a counterparty that is for some reason price insensitive. We are time insensitive and price sensitive, and all we need is somebody else who has to do something or can't do something. And we're going to take the other side of any prospect where you have to sell something, I'm buying, and you have to buy something and I'm selling. And I just need to be able to pick the price and you can pick the time and the place. And so that's the nature of everything I've ever done. That's the nature of everything I'm looking for. And that's the nature of what we'll be doing 5 years from now, even if it's not a call to SPAC. It'll be something where, properly understood, nobody would really disagree. It's not kind of a hard call judgment-wise. It's an easy call judgment-wise. It's just maybe takes a little bit of bother and effort to get access. But once somebody really knew what I was doing, I think it would be almost unanimously comfortable. It doesn't say it works every time, but it is a big discount to expected value every time. It's a good bet every time.
Nice.
And that's the kind of thing we do.
That's cool. All right. Awesome. I think this is a good place to leave it, Chris. Anyway, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today. And I'm sure we'll do this again in the not too distant future.
I really appreciate your time. Thanks for having me on.
We just spoke with Chris DeMuth Jr., who runs the Sifting the World Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for Sifting the World either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Sifting the World, or by typing Sifting the World or Chris DeMuth Jr. into the site search bar. You can also follow Chris DeMuth on seekingalpha.com and enjoy his free content there. If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast.